Just a moment. Just a moment.
Welcome to the Future Law Podcast, exploring where the law has been.
Hey Siri, take a selfie.
And where it's going.
Oh, good afternoon.
From the brilliant.
My name is Sophia, and I am the latest and greatest robot.
To the scary.
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave?
And everything in between. Please welcome your very real and very human host, Mike Madison.
Welcome to the Future Law Podcast. This is your host, Professor Michael Madison of the University of Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We used to talk about the legal profession. Now it's more common to talk about the legal industry. The change in terminology signifies a number of things. One, that the practice of law is intertwined with the business of law, something that lawyers have always known but sometimes have been reluctant to acknowledge. And two, that producing and delivering legal services involves coordinating many more people and talents than folks with law degrees. In the corporate world, the idea of the legal industry gets abbreviated in a single word, legal, so that legal is a business function, like sales or finance or human resources, itself now often rebranded as talent. And the legal function is much more today than the counsel's office of old. My guest to talk about the role of lawyers and legal professionals in the modern corporation is Stephanie Sciullo. She is the Chief Legal Officer and Vice President of MSA Safety, a public company headquartered just outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Our conversation ranged from the roles of legal operations, or legal ops, in the life of a corporate law department, to the uses of automation, to the evolving role of legal leadership in a business setting, to what this all means for, and to, new law graduates. Stephanie Sciullo, welcome to the Future Law Podcast. It's great to have you here.
Hi, Mike. Great to be here.
So let's start off with your giving a very brief introduction and overview of your company, MSA Safety, where you are the Chief Legal Officer.
Sure. Thanks, Mike. So MSA Safety is headquartered just outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We are a global company that is 107 years old, about 1.4 billion in revenue. So we're not mom and pop, but we're not the largest publicly traded company out there. We're a big small company or a small big company. And we are traded on the New York Stock Exchange. But there are a couple of things that are really unique about us. As a company, we are the only company in the world that is dedicated solely to safety. So we do all types of sophisticated safety technology that help protect the world's workers, whether they're firefighters, we do turnout gear, air breathing apparatus, fire helmets. For construction workers, we keep you safe working at heights with fall protection equipment and with hard hats. And for people working on OGP applications, we have gas detection that helps keep those workers safe. And the company was actually founded in 1914 after a large mining explosion. It was a tragedy, claimed a number of lives. And this is when you would take an open flame lamp down into a mine, and that's a very combustible environment. So our founders, two mining engineers, got together actually with Thomas Edison. They worked on this battery-powered electric cap lamp so that you didn't have to take that open flame down into the mine. You could light your way safely. And they were really thinking about how to use technology and innovation to make the world's workers safe. So today, when we're talking about corporate social responsibility and companies who do good for the world, those were the kind of things that our founders were thinking about 107 years ago.
And as you're describing that, I realize that the MSA's presence is often felt in ways in ordinary life that we don't even appreciate. Obviously, no one can see this on the podcast, and you might not even be able to see this looking at me on the screen that we're talking on today. But I have an MSA hard hat on my bookshelf behind me, because I know, you would know, that years ago, MSA did a trademark deal with the National Football League to produce MSA helmets painted like NFL football logos. And so I have a Pittsburgh Steelers themed MSA hat behind me here. So it's part of my world, even though I'm not primarily part of your audience. So let's shift gears quickly. You have were recently, relatively recently appointed chief legal officer at MSA, but you've been a member of the in-house corporate legal team for some time. Talk us through a little bit of your career trajectory. What did you do straight out of law school and how did you end up at MSA?
Out of law school, I did the typical big law route. I went to a fantastic firm here in Pittsburgh and I worked on a number of diverse matters. So I did a little bit of trademark and trade secret work, a little bit of energy work. This was actually pre-Marcellus in Pennsylvania, but my favorite client to work for was MSA Safety, that at the time was in a contract dispute with a number of its vendors, actually insurance carriers. And that's when I met the company. And what I really liked about the company, other than it was mission-driven and had proven itself to be very durable, being up 100 years old and really a company that was dedicated to its mission, it had really interesting legal problems that were also business problems. So when I had the opportunity to come in-house and to lead a complex litigation effort that they were undertaking, that they created a new position for, I really jumped at the chance to do that. So I specialized in litigation when I came in-house and worked on that complex recovery matter and all aspects of MSA's litigation, and realized really quickly that the way that business people approach problems is coupling substantive knowledge, for us, that legal knowledge, but whatever area they might be in, with these business side skills that we in the law call legal operations. So things that are services management skill sets. Can you deliver a budget? Can you deliver a project on time and on cost? Can you communicate with all of your stakeholders, whether internally or with the customers, so that they understand what you're doing and where you're going? Can you take advantage of prior knowledge through knowledge management? Can you use design thinking to build a product that is really well suited for the people who are going to be using it? So that's something that I became interested in after going in-house pretty quickly, realizing that as lawyers, we could supercharge our legal skills and our legal acumen by adding some of those legal operations skill sets on top of it.
So let's dig into that a little bit. I'm interested in how you experienced that evolution that you described, meaning how has your understanding and experience of in-house legal work evolved from your experience when you first started at MSA to the present day? You've also been very active in leadership and volunteering with the ACC, Association of Corporate Counsel. You've had engagement with CLOC. So I'm sure your perspective and experience is informed by conversations with colleagues and experiences beyond the company itself. So talk us through a little bit of what's been changing. What's more salient today in terms of the legal function, especially the kinds of things that you just described under the category of legal ops? What was less salient when you started in-house?
Yes. So I also, as you know well, taught at both of our local law schools for a period of time until about 2 years ago when I got into this role, had to transition out of that. And teaching a course that I created called In-House Counsel in Modern Corporations provided me with a space to really think about what is the role of in-house counsel, how does that differ from outside counsel, and how is it, has it evolved over time and continued to evolve? And really the reason I got into that was development, because by being a teacher, you're also a student. And I was able to learn from guest speakers that would come into class and learn by keeping up with some of the latest thought leadership that was out there. So always, really approach that always thinking about development from, you know, what can the students learn, but really what can I learn and how can I help, others learn about this evolving model of the law.
So how did your emphasis in your course change? By the time you were coming to the end of that time, what were you talking about more enthusiastically or more deliberately compared to where you had started?
Yeah, so I think, this legal operations skill set was something that I was very interested from the beginning. So in addition to thinking about how lawyers play the role of translator in-house, the role of coordinator, and the role of risk mitigator, lawyers are also thinking about these legal ops skill sets. But some of the core roles that I would talk through the teaching about how in-house counsel operate, that translator role. So taking something that is a very complex legal issue that outside counsel has really given a lot of thought to, and mixing your expertise and your knowledge of the business and how your company does things and your company's risk tolerance, and being able to take this pure legal product and translate it to a nugget of something that is really efficient and useful and practical to the business. That's one of the first roles that I would highlight, acting as a coordinator. So we have an independent obligation to your client, the corporation, and that allows you to take a step back when sometimes there are disputes or silos between departments and help different groups talk to each other, or to realize that when each group might be playing its own role, but there needs to be a commonality or a thread or a shared understanding between them. And that's something that in-house counsel, I think, are uniquely situated to do, to bring together stakeholders internally or externally. And then finally, I really enjoyed the aspect of looking at patterns of risk and thinking about how we could eliminate those at the root cause. So as a litigator, we often get problems. But if we could see common starts to those problems that could be eliminated through training or changing structurally how the client might be approaching something, that is a higher and better use of our time than just resolving the problem well. So there's in the operations world, there's a thought that you shouldn't optimize or streamline which should not exist in the first place. So from a legal perspective, we try to think about what can we eliminate, then what can we streamline? And once you have the right type of work that you're doing, then how do you source it? Do you source that legal work inside by an in-house provider? Do you go to an external provider? And then that's when you're getting into things like, do we look at value-based fees or flat fees or other things like that? But there's really a hierarchy in terms of how you're procuring that work and how you're thinking about the work.
It's so interesting to hear you talk in terms of providers and procurement, when in an earlier era, the vocabulary would have been inside counsel and outside counsel. So you've shifted not just into the language of a company that is procuring supplies from a variety of vendors. I think there may be a little bit more to it than that, that the roles and functions that you are putting together as part of your teams could come from a lot of different sources, not only from classically trained lawyers organized in classical law firms. Am I hearing you right?
Yes. So but I should say, by using that vocabulary, it's not meant to denigrate the role of counsel. So we know that counsel brings something more than just vendors. And when we're thinking about who's the best provider of work, it's not widgets. It's something that is much more sophisticated than that. But I do think that there's an unbundling of skills where we're thinking about what work are lawyers excellent at providing and what types of services are better provided by technology or by specialized business side consultants or people who are skilled at communications or relations or, you know, things along those lines. So there is really a spectrum of different kind of providers that you can bring in when we're thinking about what talent do we need to address an issue. So that's kind of the first three roles that I saw lawyers as providing in-house and then being able to layer on top that legal operations expertise. But lately, Mike, I've been thinking a lot about corporate social responsibility and crisis management and how lawyers are really well suited to help their companies through those types of issues, which require things that are, you know, there's legal aspects to that, but there's also aspects of trust, partnering, understanding, not just the business landscape, but the environment that we're in today in order to really help be a trusted advisor to the corporation.
Those areas of practice, areas of endeavor are not things that are stereotypically, historically assigned to lawyers, at least not as a matter of planning and strategy. Lawyers might come in as part of a response team. So how is it that you are being drawn to these topics? Are these areas of need and opportunity that you're perceiving with your group? Are these areas that are being sort of presented to you by senior management colleagues, or you're hearing about the changes in the marketplace from colleagues outside of MSA? So you're part of conversations, presumably among peers in other substantial companies around the world. I'm kind of interested in where this emergent interest in the lawyers participating in CSR conversations, the lawyers participating in crisis management, change management, where is that vibe, if I can use that word, coming from?
Okay, so for me personally, I was first drawn to corporate social responsibility. This is going to sound strange, but as an outcome of thinking, when I walk inside the halls of my company, we see people who are incredibly passionate about our mission of safety and what we do. And to think about how somebody from the outside can get a sense of that without being on site, but to really know that we have 500 people in engineering that think about innovating to help the lives of workers every day, or whatever other companies are doing. I think there are a lot of passionate people out there trying to make the world better. So it was really, how do you communicate that a corporation is not just a box on a piece of paper, but can actually effectuate real change in this world? And if we think about how we can move society en masse, government and corporations, and I think you need all of those, you know, both of those things and individual action. But at scale, corporations and the private sector have to work alongside individuals and governments. And, you know, if you want to layer on nonprofits and NGOs, because the most complex problems in today's world have to be solved by public-private partnerships.
Can I shift gears for a minute and shift into something that might initially sound a little bit mundane, but it's actually pretty critical, and I know that you think it's critical as well, which is automation and information technology and how automation of different sorts and smart contracting and blockchain and supply chain management are both across the company as a whole and within the legal function specifically affecting operations. And in some respects, again, speaking from the law standpoint, taking the place of what historically have been functions managed by human beings. How are you thinking about the role of technology, the role of automation in your own management practices and in your partnerships with people across the company as your clients?
When I think about automation, I don't look at it as necessarily decreasing jobs, but or decreasing costs, but increasing productivity. So any in-house person will tell you that the amount of things that you need to think about in a law department today or in a business today are more complex than they've ever been and more numerous than they've ever been, which also reflects how corporate SG&A is, you know, maybe 20%, 23% of what a corporation spends money on in today's world. In the 70s, it was maybe 3%. So there are more things to think about every single day. So to be able to take on those extra programs and the extra complexity, the more that we can automate things which might be routine and repeat and don't require complex analysis, the more that we can put our minds on things that are really, really the most complex problems so that you're practicing at the top of your license. We have a couple of people within our department who specialize in Power Apps, in the Microsoft suite of applications. So things that used to really require a lot of coding or specialized software expertise or some robotic process automation, if I'm, you know, even using the right term there, or RPA, there are no code solutions that are out of the box with some of the Microsoft suite of products. So we have people who have learned those skills and are able to take some routine and repeat aspects of legal work and automate them so that the lawyers can deal with the more interesting problems and our professionals can deal with the more interesting problems and not have to do manual data entry or Excel spreadsheets. And that increases quality, it decreases opportunity for error, and it allows us to focus on all of the other things that we need to be thinking about while reducing burnout and being overwhelmed because the number of things on the to-do list continue to grow.
Although, to play devil's advocate here for just a moment, what you're describing also increases the interdependencies and linkages between the resources that you have in-house and the companies that you're partnering with, including Microsoft, that are providing all of these solutions. So you've taken a lot of complexity, nuance, labor time, expertise that was in the heads of your people, and you have metaphorically sort of shifted it to these no-code platforms that enhance productivity, improve reliability, reduce SG&A, just to spell out the acronym, selling, general, and administrative costs, right? So all from an operations standpoint, I totally get the benefit, but there's a kind of linkage, a pattern of linkages that you now have in your own department and across the company that's sounds to me different than what it was previously.
If I understand you correctly, yes. I mean, we have taken something that used to be done individually, and now we're going to some outside tools or, we're relying on those tools or those databases. But is that any different than our cell phones, that to get the productivity that we like out of a cell phone? I mean, I'm always going to have this phone number and that subscription, and that's the trade-off that I'm willing to make for that productivity.
As long as people are aware that there is this interdependence, I think you're exactly right. At a different scale, it's very much like the dependence we all feel on our smart devices. And so when an app goes down, when a service goes down, when it fails to function as expected, we might feel as an individual consumer frustrated, disappointed, even powerless. At a corporate level, when one of your technology providers has a problem, goes down, fails to function as expected, it has a potentially much more disruptive system-wide impact on your operations.
Well, and that's an example of just, the more things advance, the more things there are to think about, because there's teams of people on that very issue, thinking about business continuity and how we would protect against those downsides if, some critical service provider would go down. And that's the same as, any company across the world is thinking about those kind of things that before we had that kind of technology, you wouldn't have a specialist in and you wouldn't have a program in. But when I think about how we would manually 10 years ago compare data that we would go out to 30 different outside counsel and say, hey, in 3 weeks, send me your Excel spreadsheet. And then somebody would have to tally all of it up and compare it to the spreadsheet the prior month or the prior year. And that would be a month's worth of time and a lot of different people to get a simple statistic or a calculation that if you have a database that people are updating day to day, you're able to run those figures instantaneously. That's a really a productivity boost for us. And that's just one thing.
For the last part of the conversation, I wanted to shift gears one more time to pick up on some of the themes that we've hit on, but focus directly on careers and expertise. And the prompt for this is a question that I get all the time from my current law students and my recent graduates. And the question is, how do you get a job? How do you build a career in an in-house law department? The traditional path, the stereotypical path, the path that you followed yourself is to graduate from law school, go to a law firm, get some experience, get some training, get some mentorship, get some view of the world, and then get recruited away out of the law firm into an in-house law department, because in-house law departments traditionally did not hire people straight out of law schools. Is that still the typical and expected path, or are there different possibilities, different opportunities to get out of law school and go straight into an in-house corporate law-related job?
I think the opportunities are increasing to be able to go straight from a law school to in-house. For us, we have, I think, two of our attorneys didn't work at law firms. They went straight in-house. But the majority of our staff had been at a firm for some amount of time first. But the thing that I'll say is, regardless of where you start your career, because there are so many different aspects of providing legal services today, for somebody who's just starting out, an opportunity to differentiate yourself is to really think about technology, project management, process improvement, and all of these other areas that are so rapidly evolving. If you can become a little bit knowledgeable in those kinds of areas, it's an opportunity to really differentiate yourself and your skill set, and it makes you unique. So you might not be first chairing a big trial until deep into your career for a banner client, but you can become knowledgeable in an aspect of technology pretty quickly in today's world. And that makes you very unique and very valuable and differentiated.
That reminds me of a phrase that you used earlier in the conversation. And it's a common phrase. I hear it from a lot of people in a lot of different sectors in the legal profession, which is that increasingly the profession educators want to encourage people to practice at the top of their license. I want to reflect on that for a second and see what you think. So I hear in that phrase a kind of subconscious or quietly expressed sense that there is still a kind of linear pathway or a linear expectation for people graduating from law school, building careers, learning basic practice skills, acquiring more responsibility, eventually finding the right place in the sense that their best and most impactful career will be at a place where they can really use those human judgment skills that distinguish them from automated systems, more routine sorts of things. But what I'm hearing you say now when we're talking about career paths, particularly straight out of law school, is that the legal profession is increasingly characterized by a diversity of roles and responsibilities. It's not simply classic delivery services for clients. There's a lot of different functions, a lot of different places to plug in. So that phrase, practice at the top of your license, may work differently depending on where you are in the organization. And I don't necessarily want you to reflect on the kind of philosophy behind all of that. I'm more interested in your experience and what you've actually seen with the people that you're working with inside your company, people that you're partnering with in other organizations as providers or partners or outside counsel. What are you actually seeing out there in the profession in terms of distribution of talent, impact, human judgment? Are people actually practicing at the top of their license? Or if not, what kind of diversity and complexity do you observe?
So one reaction I have is when I first started practicing, there was a conversation about, did clients want you to be a generalist or a specialist? And at the time it was, you know, clients really want specialists. And I think that that might still be true, but I think there's room for both. But if you're a specialist, there's more of a demand today to be a general contractor where you can be pulling in people with other skill sets and partnering with them in a way that you're still able to provide the package to the client and to be able to partner with other law firms, because sometimes we'll hire multiple law firms on things, or to be able to see the value of non-legal skill sets and to view those as being enhancing to what you're able to provide as a specialist is really powerful. Rather than at some point, it seemed like lawyers were a little bit more standoffish about partnering with other skill sets. In today's world, being able to bring them in and recognizing that, you know, whether you're the general contractor or the orchestra conductor, each one of these instruments, each one of these subcontractors provides their own role, and you can be responsible for putting together the total package for the client. And that's a really special thing to do.
Okay, you've really given me something to think about. I am going to take the orchestra conductor metaphor, and I'm going to take the general contractor metaphor, and I'm going to take those back, and I'm going to reflect on them, and we may have to come back for a follow-up podcast to disentangle and make good use of all of this richness, because I really love the musical metaphor in particular. That's something that I use with my students a fair amount. I am not a musician myself. I have no particular gifts in that area, but I understand the structural point that you're making in all kinds of respects. So I really appreciate your contributing that. Stephanie, we have to stop for today, but I really, really want to thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. There's always something provocative that comes out of our conversations. So I want to wish you all the best of success going forward, and I look forward to our continuing conversations.
Mike, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Future Law Podcast. For links to the articles mentioned and to contact the hosts, visit futurelawpodcast.com.